You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 24th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
On March 26th, 1997, in a period that Comet Hale-Bopp was at its brightest in the sky, the police discovered the bodies of 39 members of the Heaven's Gate cult who had committed group suicide.
Cheery.
Wow.
Cheery way to start the show.
The Heaven's Gate members believed the planet Earth was about to be recycled or wiped clean, and that the only chance to survive was to leave it immediately.
And so they did.
How'd that work out for them?
Who knows?
Well, we...
Maybe great.
It is sad, though. I mean, it really, you know, the whole notion of cults like that, that there is some aspect to human psychology or hardwiring that is susceptible to that sort of thing. Obviously, some people more than others. And, you know, it's sad that people can get sucked into a cult like that to the point, get so confused that they could be driven to suicide. I mean, that, think about that.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, weren't there kids involved? And, you know, I feel like there were some people involved who were killed that didn't actually necessarily want to commit suicide.
That's happened in other mass suicides. I don't know that, that's true of the Heaven's Gate cult suicide. Mm-hmm. They were all working like as a company. They were doing like web development or something, weren't they?
The Jim Jones cult. Yeah, there was lots of
deaths. Oh yeah, I'm probably thinking
of Jim
Jones.
The group used apparently a lot of Star Trek nomenclature. Mm-hmm. Right? They had their away team. And other things. So they kind of were run like the bridge of a ship.
That would have sucked me in.
It was a nerd cult. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your nerd cult, Star Trek, UFOs, alien abduction. Remember they bought that alien abduction insurance prior to all of this? And
what was the name of the leader?
Marshall Applewhite.
That's the guy. You look into his eyes and he looks crazy. Now, again, that could just be confirmation bias. I know he's crazy.
Is he the one? He has like white hair.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that stare. You know, that Charles Manson stare. Basically, is what I equate.
That 1,000-yard stare.
Mm. To wrap this up, though, two former members of the Heaven's Gate cult, Wayne Cook and Charlie Humphreys, were their names. They later committed suicide in a similar manner to the group.
Huh. Really? I didn't know that.
In February of 1998. So this was a pretty influential leader. And
I wonder why. Like, I mean, wasn't the whole point that they had to do it then because of Hale-Bopp being? This was the Hale-Bopp one.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, the Hale-Bopp comet.
So, I mean, it's not like Hale-Bopp came back in February 1998. So, where did they think their UFO was? If they were,
it's a good question. You know.
Well, on a brighter note, today, the day that we're recording is Houdini's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, Harry!
Hey,
he's dead.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, but
cult did he belong to?
The cult of skepticism.
Yes,
the best cult.
Houdini totally rocked. Google even gave him a little homage today with their little Houdini image,
Houdini poster.
Yeah, they should have done a better job with it though. They should have made it some animated freaky thing.
It?
But yeah, it's kind of weird. But I'm glad they did.
It's period. It looks period though.
It does. But they could have done something like Pac-Man where it was all animated and.
You're just never satisfied, Bob. It's never good enough for you.
Sometimes it is.
Bob, I'm going to punch you in the stomach when you're not looking someday.
Yeah, what kind of random violent outburst was that?
I'll be fine. My appendix is not ruptured. I shall be fine.
Thank you.
Let's move on. Last week, we were talking about the Japanese earthquake and mentioned the fact that, well, nobody predicted it. After we recorded that show, I did discover that somebody now is claiming that the earthquake in Japan was predicted. You guys remember Michael Horn?
Oh, boy. Hard to forget him.
Does he still send a spam email every once in a while?
He does, and he did. He sent me and others a spam email claiming that Billy Meier made a stunning prediction of the Japanese earthquake. Stunning.
Mm. I'm sure that this is very specific and obvious.
Well, this is he predicted in the March of 2011, mm-hmm. a massive 9.0 earthquake will strike Japan, resulting in a tsunami that will threaten their nuclear reactors.
Wow, that is very specific. I think this person should immediately get $1 million from James Randi.
Right.
or someone else.
Immediately.
But except, of course, that he did not predict that.
Oh, what?
He was he wasn't quite that specific.
No, not quite, but close.
Close.
Tell him
this is what
he
actually
really said, Steve.
What he actually said, this is his stunning prediction. Also, the land with the cherry blossom becomes shaken, and the city at the fault becomes totally buried. There you go.
Wow, so, there you go. That's close, very close.
Okay.
Wow. Let me guess,
no
date or time assigned to that, right? It was just a general
that prediction
future
was made
prediction.
About 35 years ago.
And at some point in the future, this cherry land of the cherry tree will
shaken,
shake.
So
cherry blossom
shaken, not stirred.
Will have an earthquake. That's really specific. It could also mean Washington D.C.
Right. The city by the fault would be buried. Was there? I mean, this was out in the ocean, the epicenter, and there was no city that was even remotely buried.
Atlantis.
Right. You could always metaphorically say a city was buried in rubble, but you're right, Bob. No city was totally buried.
You know, I mean, stunning, very stunning.
So this was, the shtick of Billy Meier. Billy Meyer's the Swiss farmer who's been faking, UFO encounters for the last few decades.
Badly.
And what he does very badly, what he does is he writes these long conversations that he allegedly has with the UFO people. And part of the proof that these are real is the stunning predictions that the aliens make, like the cherry blossom one. So this was from a conversation apparently in the mid-70s, and SEMJAS, S-E-M-J-A-S-E, that's the alien who made these predictions. That's totally a made-up name.
Very alien.
But this is in the middle of a long, rambling, very Nostradamus-esque prediction.
The next sentence is something about the people and land of the lion's sword who will also suffer.
Yes.
Where's that?
From
what's
the
happening?
Land of the boot, one will speak very sadly.
Libya.
And also from Libya. The lands with the boon of earth gold.
Oh, come on. Land of the boot is obviously Italy.
Well, that's the first thing you think of, sure. Now, I looked up
so
cherry blossom.
There's one sad person in Italy. It's about Berlusconi. It's obviously
The sex scandal? Yeah.
So I looked up cherry blossom. And certainly Japan is known for its cherry blossoms. So is Washington, D.C. and Vancouver, and also China and Vietnam, and there are other countries as well. So that's vague enough. But you have to wonder if SEMJAS knew that there was going to be an earthquake in Japan in 2011, why didn't they just say Japan? Why land with the cherry blossom?
Well, because they don't know. Their Rand McNally map doesn't have the names of the land masses on there. They just, look down and they attribute, okay, there's cherry blossoms there. That's the land of the cherry blossoms.
Powerful telescopes they must have.
Oh, don't get me started.
Maybe their telescopes just saw that, this is an island that shakes all the time.
Yes.
I mean, they have earthquakes all the time. It's really not a surprise.
This prediction, even if you interpret shaken as earthquake, which is honestly that's reasonable, shaken, buried, they're saying this is good, there's going to be an earthquake. This prediction is the equivalent of saying at some undefined time in the future, there's going to be an earthquake somewhere that has something to do with the cherry blossom. And even if you argue that cherry blossom can only refer to Japan, which I think is not reasonable, then all that means is they said at some point in the future, Japan will be struck by an earthquake. That's it. That's the prediction. And it took 35 years for that prediction to come true.
Stunning.
Stunning.
Well, it didn't, though. It came true, immediately. Japan had an earthquake immediately after this was written.
Thank goodness for Michael Horn. I'm so glad he's keeping us up to date on these very important matters.
Right. I mean, this is on the point of being delusional, to think this is a stunning prediction. Seriously. Bob, you're going to tell us about the honeybee approach to robots.
Sweet.
Yeah, this one. Nice. Yeah, this story really caught my attention. Now, this past week, a researcher published a plan to explore Mars robotically, but it didn't involve one big rover like we're used to. He wants to use swarms of robots to do difficult things, like search Mars for caves that could reveal hints of life. Now, the swarm robotics is an idea I think that's really going to be big in the next few decades, and we'll see if I can convince you of that. The paper was recently published by Acta Astronautica by University of Southampton engineer Aaron Kisdy. Aaron's idea is to send not just one big, heavy, expensive rover to Mars, but 40 to 60 small robots to Mars and kind of just send them all out looking for specific things, specific conditions on Mars. Like if you're looking for caves, for example, you would look for, say, a specific drop in temperature that would indicate that you would be in the cave, or a drop in the amount of light that,
yeah.
that's hitting you. So once all these conditions are met, the idea is then to have the robot go back to the central area, probably where they, you know, where they all dispersed from, and to upload all the relevant information of this area, the location, temperature, all sorts of stuff. So then once this is done, the robot could also evaluate what other robots have uploaded, because all the robots will be doing the same thing. They all come back, upload their information, and then each robot, once these robots have uploaded their information, then they look at all the other information that all the other robots have uploaded. And that's kind of a key aspect of the swarm robotics, is that there's this communication between all the members. So once they evaluate all this other information, they kind of decide, all right, do we start a new search for another cave, or maybe perhaps there's one cave that somebody already found that's very promising, and they'll do even more investigations of it. And also a robot could even say, well, you know, I found the best cave. This is the cave that meets all the parameters, and this is the cave that I'm going to recommend.
Best cave scenario.
Yes, and they would just upload that information to wherever that would go, to Mission Control or whatever. So in this way, the robots come to a consensus relatively quickly, which is which spot is the best, and only at that time would the big, expensive, lumbering rovers kind of head over there to this pre-selected location that all these robots agreed on. Now, the connection with the honeybees, and actually also some species of ants, is that they use this behavior to find promising nesting sites. It's called quorum sensing, where they will send out members of their other honeybees or ants. They would send them out, and they would all be looking for the perfect nest for themselves, and then they would come back and communicate that in a special way, and it would come to a consensus. And at the end of the day, you've picked a really good site, and you don't need everyone visiting all these different spots and voting. It's kind of this quorum sensing kind of like gives you a quick and efficient way to come to a conclusion. And swarm robotics then, it's basically just a unique way of coordinating many robots, say from dozens. I mean, you could scale this up to many, many thousands. It's really hard to coordinate lots of robots together. So, this is one of the ways that they might do this. Because conventional methods really aren't up to the task when you start really getting lots of different robots together working on a task. And it's kind of an outgrowth of artificial swarm intelligence that they've been working on, and also swarming behavior that you find in nature, insects and ants and bacteria. The idea then is that very simple rules can produce a very efficient and often complex resulting behaviors. Think of the best example, and I love this one, is the flocking behavior of birds. We've all seen it, right? How they move in unison in this beautiful, like, fluid manner, avoiding things like obstacles and predators. And schools of fish are the same thing. Right. I mean, there's very simple rules. If there's no one bird that's in the middle or somewhere saying, all right, Harry, you go this way, and Cindy, you look out for Harry over there. There's no one directing. There's no traffic controller. There's just very simple rules that these birds are following. Like, for example, stay a certain distance away from the birds that are near you, and a few other rules. And if you follow these very simple rules, you can get this very complicated behavior. And it's just similar to what we can get with this swarm robotics idea. I think there's a lot of benefits that can be derived from this. You're essentially maximizing the search area and minimizing the search time. Like when you're talking about expensive robots going to Mars, I mean every ounce matters. So anything to increase efficiencies, I think, would save tons and tons of money. And it's obviously a lot cheaper, right, to build 40 or 60 of these inexpensive robots rather than just like one huge rover. Those rovers cost millions of dollars. And they're also fragile. The other big advantage is that if you lose one or two of these little robots, it doesn't matter. You could still attain your goal. But for the rover, as awesome as they are and as successful as these rovers have been, you get one critical error, one critical flaw or damage, and it could be all over, and that's it. I mean, how many things have we lost on Mars?
Now, Bob, when you're talking about swarming robots, isn't the first thing that comes to mind something absolutely horrific, like, say, those Matrix robots that come after you and try to break into your ship and kill you? Things like
yeah,
that?
Weren't they cool? I love those robots.
On the movie, yeah. In real life, yes. Not so much. I don't want to be that guy to bring up.
Or let's do a more realistic scenario. Just in Minority Report, there were similar, you know, small insectoid robots that were used, like, by the police to search for a fugitive in a building. So they could search the whole building.
That's
and
right.
They invaded everybody's privacy and just crawled all over the place.
Right. I mean, of course, there's going to be applications like that. But it's technology we're talking about, kids. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. But the benefits. I mean, think of things like search and rescue. Imagine after after the earthquake in Japan, if you had, you know, at some point in the future, perhaps buildings will have hundreds of these little tiny bots just like waiting for a disaster to strike, a fire or an earthquake. And then as soon as it hits, they can kind of spread out and find out. They could find all the people that are alive. They could find, you know, any, say, potential gas leaks or other things that need to be found during the search and rescue. And then by the time the people get there and the dogs and maybe the other more sophisticated robots, you already know where, you know, you already have this database of information that's already been gathered and ready for you to deal with.
So you're saying there isn't just evil applications?
Yeah, that's what's confusing me here, is because every time you use the word, for instance, swarm, I think evil. Swarm.
I know.
Robot how about this? Swarm.
Right. Here's a cool one. You guys know the Roomba, the vacuum cleaning robot.
Roomba swarm. Can you even picture that? Like killing your dog and...
How about instead of one, you know, big Roomba, how about if you have, if you have like 30, 40, or 50 of them in your house, all little ones, all these tiny ones that could clean your house much quicker.
Well, then what's my cat going to ride efficiently. Around on, Bob?
Yeah, right.
Drive your cats crazy.
They'll sit on your dog robot. Okay?
Now, we're kidding, obviously, but the concept is that, you know, depending on the application, you may want lots of small robots instead of a medium size or a big robot. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think you point out a lot of applications where it makes sense that you would want to take the swarm approach.
Bob, for the example in the article, how are those things powered?
I don't remember them actually specifically saying how they were powered. I mean, they could be a combination of solar, battery. There could be some way to generate power.
Little squirrels.
Yeah, there you go.
on treadmills.
Very little squirrels.
I would think that would be one of the major stumbling blocks or hurdles that needs to be accomplished.
Well, yeah, battery technology is always a sticking point. But, I mean, I don't think they'd be big enough to have these little nuclear generators or other devices that they use based on, say, nuclear decay to create the energy. But you could have one unit that they can go back and just plug in and recharge into. I mean, there's lots of ways around it.
Right. Sounds cool.
Or scary, if you're Rebecca.
Or scary.
Yeah, until they murder you. Whatever.
Rebecca, tell us about the sexual preference of mice.
I would love to, Steve. bold new directions for scientists studying mice. They can now make bisexual mice, which is mostly fun because it's really fun to watch tiny mice orgies. Basically, researchers in China have discovered that a chemical in the brain, particularly serotonin, is responsible for the sexual preferences of mice. They bred male mice whose brains weren't at all receptive to serotonin. And when they gave those mice a choice between mating with boy mice or girl mice, they expressed no preference. When those mice were introduced to male mice just on their own, they would proceed to hump them. So they were into both male and female mice. They also bred a different set of mice that lacked the gene that produces serotonin, and they saw the same thing happen. They also were able to reintroduce the preference for females by injecting serotonin right into the mice's brains.
Mm.
Now, I know that right now there's one of those hardcore Christian fundamentalists listening who like to retrain the gays into being straight, and they're thinking, great, now all we have to do is inject their brain with serotonin.
That's right. They're thinking they've found the cure for that gay disease.
Assuming the animal model discovery translates to humans, but that's another story.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm about to say, is that I'm sorry to break it to those people, but we can't really say that we could see the same exact thing in humans, because mice tend to base their sexual preferences very much on smell. At least that's the thinking as of right now. Humans, however, don't use their sense of smell to nearly the same degree as mice. So while this might have some sort of implications for how we view sexual preference in humans, it's not the whole story.
Oh, it certainly isn't the whole story. I mean, this kind of research where you're looking at one thing like this, you never is going to inform even the sexuality of mice. You know, there are multiple ways to interpret this study. For example, the lack of activity of serotonin could just be upping their sexual behavior all around. It's not that it's not
necessarily. They want to screw everything.
Yeah, they just screw everything. So it's not necessarily erasing their preference so much as just making them hypersexual
I've known a lot of bisexuals in my time, and that pretty much fits the definition.
I'm
going to get some angry emails from bisexuals now.
You need to do a lot more studies in this to control for more variables to know exactly how to interpret this. And then, as Rebecca said, how do we extrapolate this to humans? Is this something that's common to mammalian brains, or is this something that is different between mice and humans? That needs to be sorted out as well.
Of mice and men.
But I do think that the bigger point here that Rebecca is getting to, which I agree with, is that our sexual preferences are determined by our brains. You know, it's not something that we just decide the evidence does not show that you get raised to have a certain sexual preference or it's culture or anything. It's just, it's
biology.
It's biology. It's the way your brain is hardwired. And that in and of itself is also complicated. It's partly genetic, partly epigenetic. The environment of the womb, for example, may, again, have to do with relative behaviors of certain neurotransmitters.
And that's not to say that the environment outside the womb has zero effect. It could be some small effect.
You mean after you're born, the way the person's raised? Well, I think that it affects behavior. I don't know that we can say that there's any evidence to show that it affects just your innate sexual preference.
I've never seen a study that ever suggested that, but.
I guess what I'm driving at is often it's hard to find something that is 100% determined genetically. There's usually an interplay between the two one could be very dominant, as is this case. Obviously, it's a super strong genetic.
You're right, Bob. And that's how I characterize it. I always say dominant. It's a dominantly hardwiring or genetics. You would shy away from ever saying something's 100%. The brain is something that interacts with the environment, so there's always going to be some interaction. But it also not every trait is the same mix of environment and genetic, epigenetic factors, developmental factors. We could say some things are more environmental, other things are more developmental, and sexual preference seems to be, as we said, dominantly developmental, and that makes sense. It makes sense that there would be strong evolutionary pressures involving our sexuality. I mean, that's the route to reproduction and spreading our genes into the next generation. So it makes sense it would be dominantly genetic.
Yeah, it's so very annoying to hear people say that, just don't do it. Just stop.
Just don't do
just
it.
Like, turn the switch off. Yeah. It's like, wait.
I always imagined somebody saying that to me. Just stop being a heterosexual.
That's a common response to why did you choose to be gay? It's to ask, well, at what point in your life did you choose to be straight? And if you made the choice, then why don't, just for a day, just be gay.
Gay it up. Gay it up.
Yeah. You find that to be, a choice that you don't like, but you didn't make that,
Now, that's a great way to put it.
You decide not to like it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Imagine living in a culture or in a society where your sexual preference was taboo. And this goes beyond just simple, gay, straight, too. I mean, I also feel really sorry for people who are sexually attracted to little kids. Not that – don't get me wrong, I would never excuse the behavior. There's absolutely no excuse for the behavior. But some of these people say, I have these desires. They're overwhelming, and it sucks to be them. You know what I mean? There's zero excuse for ever acting on them. They should never act on their desires. But I would hate to have you know, desires hardwired into my brain that I could never act upon.
Right.
Because
they
were
illegal.
They were illegal. They're horrific. You know, they're immoral. Just imagine.
Or just culturally unaccepted. Yeah.
Right. Unacceptable. Right. Like having a whole bunch of skulls in your basement. It's something wrong with that.
Clearly more advanced.
Is that really a sexual preference? Because I've heard of Bob's skull collection, but this is the first I've ever heard.
It could be a sexual preference. You never
hey.
Know.
Believe me. O-M-G. No, there's no connection.
Evan, there was a minor advance in the science of prebiotic chemistry. What happened before life on this earth?
Yeah, what happened before life on this earth? And this has been a question that scientists have been studying for some time now. In fact, back in 1953, a gentleman by the name of Stanley Miller, a 23-year-old graduate student who worked in the laboratory of Harold Urey at the University of Chicago, and he performed experiments that attracted global attention at the time and are still talked about today. Miller was the first person to show that amino acids and other organic molecules could be formed under conditions thought to simulate those of the early Earth. And recently, some of those old experiments and vials and tests and results have been dusted off and reanalyzed by former student of his, Jeffrey Botta, went back and did some reanalysis of the original materials.
They kept it.
And,
they kept that stuff.
Yeah,
that's
200
that's awesome.
Vials of material, yeah.
They find little eyes inside staring back at them. Little tiny spaceships cruising around inside.
We have the advantage of looking at the experiments conducted in the 1950s using 21st century technology and 55 years of more information, basically, that have accumulated. And it's further reinforced. It has further solidified the original experiments and with great success, actually. More amino acids than were originally discovered were actually in some of these vials and pieces of data.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the classic Miller experiments. Again, it doesn't show us how life arose. It just shows that if you simulate the conditions of the early prebiotic Earth, that just volcanoes and lightning and the types of things that were in the atmosphere at the time could form amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein and, of course, among the fundamental building blocks of life. So that, you know, that certainly supports the notion that life could have arose on the early Earth if it was really easy to produce massive quantities of building block material. It takes you only one step towards building a model of how life could have arisen, but I think it's an important step.
It is an important step. It also goes to showcase how important things like the volcanic eruptions that were happening in the early Earth contributed to that development of early life. Higher levels of H2S, which is hydrogen sulfide.
Smelly.
Yeah, very smelly. But,
it's rotten eggs, isn't it?
That's how they describe the smell. It smells kind of like rotten eggs. But for example, in some of the experiments that were tested back in 1953 by Miller, in some of these concoctions, he came up with about 7 or 8 amino acids. But reanalyzed and recognizing the hydrogen sulfide that was an important precursor to this sort of chemistry, they came up with concoctions that yielded 20 or more amino acids.
Right.
And don't forget the potential contribution of meteorites. They found similar materials in meteorites, other biological precursors that also could have seeded the Earth as well and contributed.
Right. But it also shows how common it is. That's not just on Earth, that these same amino acids are being made outside of the Earth, but in other conditions. So it seems to be something that happens spontaneously and in many, many different environments. One fun topic before we finish with the news section, there was a recent survey of attitudes about science or science fiction done by the Birmingham Science City. Did you guys see this? Did you guys all take the quiz? I asked you to take the quiz.
Of course.
I did.
I did.
Bob, you got 8 out of 8, right?
Hold on, I didn't take the quiz. Wait, what is this?
Let's take it live. Here we go. We'll go through each question.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Here's the first one. You have to decide, is this science, fact, or fiction? Of course, you know, this is close to my heart. Here's the first question. Time travel like that depicted in Doctor Who is currently possible. Science, fact, or fiction?
Fiction. Ooh, I'm going to go with fiction.
That is correct. Guess how? But what's interesting here is the percentage of people who guessed that it was science. What do you think that is?
Oh, God.
Ooh.
5%.
30%.
Oh, more than that.
Yeah,
30%?
I got it.
Exactly
what?
30%.
One out of three
30%?
People?
Now, you have to wonder if this survey is contaminated, you know, by people being tongue-in-cheek or whatever, trolls. But still, that's...
Where was this survey given?
The survey was done by the Birmingham Science City.
Okay, so we're talking about England.
Yes. We're
talking about the place
where... So they're familiar.
Where, well, we're talking about the place where they answered
like
on the
Doctor
census
Who.
That their religion was the force in large enough numbers that it became like a considered a religion.
Oh, that's cool.
The force is a religion?
Well, yeah. I mean, like this happened a few years ago. And when it happened, I think everybody was like, oh, those cheeky Brits. They're so clever and cute. And it turns out, no, they really believe it.
Yeah. They're not just being cheeky.
Scary.
I guess not. Like,
or coy or something.
So Lucas is like L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah. Apparently they actually believe it.
All right. Here's the next one. You can have a clone made of your pet. Fact or fiction?
Fact.
That's fact.
That is fact. The first cloned pet was produced in 2004, a cat called Little Nicky. And if you have thousands of dollars laying around, you can have your pet cloned.
What's the name of that terrible Adam Sandler film?
I don't know.
Boy, there are so many. Keep going.
There's the next one. Tractor beams raised that lift or draw in objects are possible.
Yeah, that's fact. We had a news item about that.
Yeah, I remember reading
science,
about that
science. Wasn't it science or fiction a couple
it
weeks
It was.
Ago?
But you know what? I read this one. I'm like, are they talking about that nano tractor beam that we talked about from science or fiction? or like a macroscopic tractor beam? So I wasn't really sure how to answer.
No.
They were talking about the nano tractor beam.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. They didn't specifically say it was like a Star Trek tractor beam. But so that one was yes.
So that was fact. The next one is, it is possible to teleport blank. And you have to fill in the blank. Data, people, bacteria.
Data.
Yeah, that was easy.
Data. Although even then I was thinking, even that is a little iffy because you can't make information go faster than the speed of light. They were talking about the whole quantum information, about the aspects of the particle. So I think data is a little misleading there.
Yeah, it is.
It's a little bit, but they didn't say information. I mean,
yeah, it's true.
You're right, and you kind of get the idea. You are
teleporting the quantum states.
The state.
Steve, so
that's
in
exactly
a sense,
what percentage of people thought it was possible to teleport people?
Oh God,
30%.
Really?
25%.
12.
25%.
Ah, 1 in 4.
1 in 4.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Think that you can teleport people. What do they think all these people are doing in the giant metal crafts flying through the air? Like, what's the
wouldn't that impact their lives? Wouldn't that be like in their face? Like,
only rich
people
can afford to do it.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, that's what it is. Yes.
Only the government can use it.
Yeah, they're hiding that technology.
All right, here's number 5. A garment that can hide people, a Harry Potter style invisibility cloak exists.
Well, yeah, that's been reported just exactly like that in the Daily Mail, like once a week.
That one's science fiction.
Now wait, we've talked about invisibility.
No, but they're talking
cloaks.
People.
But they're talking they really mean a cloak like Harry Potter, where you drape a cloth over yourself and you're invisible. Yeah.
What was the item we talked about last year?
They're typically microscopic and not invisible wavelengths, microwaves and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we're kind of getting there with the metamaterials, but no.
And then people extrapolate to the most absurd manifestation of it, like invisibility cloaks. 22% of people thought it was possible.
I'm actually surprised that that's lower because that literal headline actually has appeared in the newspaper.
Right. It's
and it's Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Potter.
Harry Potter.
All right. Lightsabers in classic Star Wars flashy battle style are available.
Yes, from Kenner and Mattel on the store shelf. That's about 1995.
It. So, yeah, I guess you could say the toy or like real working functioning lightsabers.
I'm sure they were talking about real.
They were, but I guess the question is, what did people think? 22% thought that they were lightsabers.
So again, one that we could find understandable, people answering yes is actually lower than the more ridiculous ones.
Like teleporting people.
Yeah.
Not good, Brits. Come on, pick it up.
Scientists have built a device that harnesses brain waves, moving objects based on a subject's will.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. They sell that in Sky Mall.
Yes.
And we saw it at the Connecticut Science Center in action, sort of.
It is true. I think that's a little misleading the way it was stated. It's not like you're moving it with your brain waves. The brain waves are not being harnessed. It's just that your EEG is being interpreted, and it's, you know, the computer moves something based upon what it thinks your EEG is doing. The one we saw at that Science Center, Evan, was just terrible.
It was terrible.
I mean,
why?
There were so few leads, and it was just, you know, the execution of it was horrible. And they might try to make it seem like if you concentrate hard, you can get the thing to move across. And that's nonsense. It's just random interpretation of your brainwaves. 30% of respondents said that it was possible. And again, it is if you give it a generous interpretation. I know we know what they're talking about, but I do think it was a little misleading.
That survey, I mean, getting 8 out of 8 is really not difficult for, I mean, guys, we're into science fiction, we're into science. We are like the perfect candidates to kick ass on that type of quiz. And
yes.
I suspect if we gave it to the people that listen to the podcast, the scores would be incredible. This is meant for just people that just, you know, aren't like us, you know, and
yeah,
it doesn't surprise
blokes.
Me. And you know, if you're not into science or science fiction, I could see, you know, messing up on a bunch of them.
Yeah, and they're being, I think they're being a little misleading in some of the questions, but. Oh, I agree.
The last question.
Yeah, last was science can mimic the stage trick of levitation, and demonstrations have even shown a frog levitating in midair. Yeah.
I read a blog about that.
That, of course, is true. That's the famous levitating frog from the cover of Nature magazine. You know, this demonstrating magnetic fields generated by superconductors. I don't think anyone's done it with a person yet, though.
Not that I'm aware of.
So you could do a little frog magic show, but not with people. So yeah, that one was true. So that's kind of a fun quiz. It is surprising that the one I found most surprising is that 30% of people thought that we were teleporting people around. I
mean,
And the time travel one is pretty bad.
That's pretty bad too. Yeah, that's as bad. That is
that. Yeah, I think that one takes a cake.
So maybe what it is that people really don't have a clue what the words teleport and time travel mean, or really what they are. They must be clueless about those facts or those concepts.
Maybe. At least.
Well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy?
It is. Who's That Noisy is the time of the show when we play an audio clip that relates to science or skepticism in some way, and we ask the listeners to identify that noise. I'm going to play for you now last week's Who's That Noisy?
It was so exciting because it was like we thought we were doing the things for the first time they've ever been done. And it was the first time they'd ever been done that cheap using a lot of the LSI technology.
And that was?
Ever heard of Steve Wozniak?
Oh, of course.
Never heard of him.
A bit.
He's some guy who did something.
A lot of our listeners have, too.
Yeah, they sure have.
Oh, boy.
Now, that was an old interview. I pulled that from like 1984. So I was hoping
Stone Age.
That, you know, people wouldn't so readily recognize his voice, you know, the earlier version of Steve Wozniak, but they did. And he is, of course, one of the co-founders of Apple Computer Incorporated, along with Steve Jobs and Ronald Wayne. His inventions and machines are credited with contributing significantly to the personal computer revolution of the 1970s. Wozniak created Apple I and Apple II computers in the mid-70s.
I've heard of that. Something to do with the Beatles, right?
So yes, Apple, Beatles, something like that. And his nickname is The Woz.
The Woz.
The Woz.
It's a good nickname.
And that's where the term up the wazoo came from.
Oh, boy.
No. Congratulations to Alvarop from the message boards, who was the first to guess correctly. Congratulations. Well done.
What's next?
Are you ready
what
for the
said.
Next one, Rebecca?
Yes.
Are you ready for the next one? All right. Let's move on to this week's Who's That Noisy? Now listen closely. Listen closely, folks. Who's That Noisy?
Who's That Noisy?
God.
Now, that was obviously a nature sound of some sort. You could hear the animals and birds and things. But there was something else in that audio track that is unique. And you must identify what is the unique part of that noisy. All right? Mm-hmm. Give it a couple listens and give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. I think we have time for some emails. We don't have any interview this week, so it's just us this week. The first email comes from Michael Michalczyk in California. Sorry if I mispronounced your name. And Michael writes, "This was published in the conservative media. It seems likely that this is a horrid case of cherry-picking and distortion, but I would like to know your opinion, any merit to this viewpoint." And he links to an article by Ann Coulter, that esteemed scientist.
Doctor. Professor.
On professor. Called A Glowing Report on Radiation. Coulter writes an article in which she argues that radiation is not as dangerous as the media makes it out to be, and that essentially low levels of radiation can actually have positive health effects, that it could be healthy, and that even doses of radiation that are above the minimum safety levels actually do wonderful things like decrease cancer rates and are positive. And therefore, it's just these crazy environmentalists, you know, fear-mongering about radiation is what's going on.
Here's the problem. One of the problems, but I think the major problem.
That she doesn't know what she's talking about?
She's an idiot.
Not that.
Yes, you are correct.
No. I'm not going to say that because people, especially politicians, Steve, and political writers, and Steve, we've recognized this quite a lot, especially lately, when these political writers start writing about things that are not political, right? And they start going into things like, you know, science and medicine and these other things. They are so way out of their element that they absolutely discredit themselves, essentially, I think, right off the bat.
It's a huge credibility hit. But it's a combination of being, you know, insufficiently literate in science and also having, you know, very definitive, some might even say extreme political views, or just the fact that, you know, you have an ideological position that you've staked out and you're defending, you're going to try to defend it with science, and you're scientifically illiterate.
And let's be clear, like, this person never had any credibility to begin with, considering that her last book was about, like, the myth of evolution. It's not like she just randomly, you know, danced into the scientific field on this one article. Like,
no one's saying that.
Yeah, she's just, like, constantly exposing her scientific ignorance to the world, and it's embarrassing.
By the way, she has still not answered my open public challenge to debate her on this show about evolution and creationism. So, Anne, if you're listening, just send me an email. We'll do it.
Well, maybe she's smarter than we're giving her credit for in that regard.
You never
she's
know.
Smart enough to stay away. She's a lawyer.
Maybe pigs
right?
will fly.
she studied law. She was a lawyer for a while. She should stick to that. She should make comments about that. Right?
But let's actually look at the science. I mean, there is an interesting scientific backdrop to this claim that low levels of radiation have positive health effects. That phenomenon generally is called hormesis, when something which is either toxic or harmful at lower doses can actually be helpful in some way, not necessarily in the same way that it's harmful, if you know what I mean. And the theory of hormesis itself is controversial. She's basically talking about radiation hormesis. Interestingly, hormesis is something that homeopaths use in order to justify homeopathy, the like cures like bit. Of course, they don't treat people with small doses. They treat people with non-existent doses, so it doesn't apply. And also, hormesis, if it does exist, we're talking about there's some specific mechanism there. There's something going on. It's not a generic principle of biology. It's just with certain specific substances, they may produce an effect that, you know, at low doses, they may have more of a positive than negative effect. But as you raise the dose, then toxicity kicks in. That's pretty much every drug, you know, that we use.
Exactly. Even water.
Yeah, there's a dose range at which drugs have some effect that can be exploited for benefit, but at higher doses, pretty much everything becomes toxic. But the specific notion of hormesis is that it has to do with how we extrapolate or graph the toxicity versus dose. It's really easy to document in studies, whatever kind of study, whether it's animal studies, experimental studies, or observational studies with people, it's really easy to see a big toxic effect. So our most reliable data about the dose response effect of toxins is at the higher dose, higher toxicity end of the spectrum. It's hard to detect tiny amounts of toxicity, right? By definition, it's smaller, it's less of an effect, it's harder to see against the background of noise. So we have, the closer you get to zero, you know, as you're trying to extrapolate the graph down, the less reliable our data becomes. So we often will take the objective, clearly measurable, high toxic effects and then extrapolate down in order to see, like, when does this become essentially zero? And the controversy is, well, how do we extrapolate that line? Should we assume it's linear all the way down to zero? That is the approach that most government agencies will take when coming up with safe limits. It's called the linear non-threshold approach. You extrapolate toxicity, you know, as a straight line, and you assume that there's no threshold of toxicity, meaning that below some dose, there's zero toxicity. The toxicity doesn't kick in until some point. It's not that anyone thinks that that's necessarily how every toxin works. The threshold concept actually makes sense for a lot of things. I think a lot of things probably do have a minimum threshold of toxicity. It's just really hard to prove that empirically through experimentation. So taking the linear non-threshold approach is a way of having a buffer of a safety buffer built in, right? You're assuming a worst case scenario or at least close to a worst case scenario, and then you develop your safety limits based upon that, even though you know that the assumptions may not be literally true. They're the most cautious assumptions. There are other possible models. You can have a super linear curve where toxicity rises faster at the low end of dose and then sort of levels off a little bit. Or you can have sublinear.
Nanolinear curve.
Sublinear, basically. Yeah, where toxicity is slowly picks up and then it gets greater and greater at a faster pace, as you increase dose. Or you can have the hormesis curve where it actually dips below zero, meaning that there's not only is there no toxicity, there's actually a benefit for a while before the toxicity kicks in. Again, this does not have to be universally true for all toxins. You know, different toxins can have different curves. You know, like antibiotics kill off bacteria at low doses and at high doses will kill you. So that's, you know, for one example of a hormesis-like effect can be present with a substance. So when it comes to radiation, again, the data for radiation hormesis, that small doses of radiation might have some health benefits, is really ambiguous and controversial. What Ann Coulter did was she cherry-picked horrendously and grossly misinterpreted the data. So she went through a bunch of cherry-picked studies, you know, misrepresented them in many cases, and or just gave, like, for example, there were times when she relied upon outdated information and didn't give you the updated information, you know.
In 2001? What the heck, Ann?
But it's worse than that. I mean, it's really worse than that. I mean, so she chose her position, then she cherry-picked the data to fit the position, right? That's classic pseudoscience.
Classic.
But when you take a more objective look at this, it's not clear at all that there's a hormesis effect for low doses of radiation. So it's not impossible in that radiation may have certain biological effects. Of course, the toxicity from radiation is that it ionizing radiation is powerful enough to break chemical bonds, so it can cause damage in your cells by by breaking bonds in the DNA, causing mutations, and also causing the release of free radicals, which then causes cell damage. So that's how radiation causes damage. And it makes sense that that could happen at any dose, right? Even a single cosmic ray can hit, if it hits, happens to hit a DNA molecule, can cause a mutation, which could then turn it into a cancer cell. You have to be unlucky, you know, but there doesn't appear to be a threshold for radiation, is my point. There is certainly a dose response. The more radiation, the more damage, the more mutations, the more likelihood the mutations will be bad. But there doesn't seem to be any threshold, because even a single particle of radiation could potentially, if you're really unlucky, could potentially cause a problem. But at low doses, you know, effects that radiation have on cells can also cause the cell to respond with protective mechanisms that may have more benefits than the radioactivity that induced them. Yeah. So again, it's not like it's a crazy idea. It's just that there's no evidence. The evidence is preliminary and ambiguous at best. We're not at the point where we could say yes, there's radiation hormesis. Very interesting, you know, whole concept scientifically, which Coulter butchers for her ideological agenda. All right, well, let's go on. Bob, you're going to take this one, I think. This is another perpetual motion machine. We got to talk about this every now and then, once a year or so. This one comes from Philip Guilford in Florida, and Philip writes, "My uncle recently sent me a YouTube link about Doug Conson. I agree with my uncle that he's definitely a whack job. He's claiming that his Unity pulse motor is over 100% efficient. Now, I just took thermodynamics last fall, and I know from my studies that this is an impossibility. I'm sure there is more than one way to tackle this one. However, if you guys have the time, could you tell me why this guy's a fraud by using electron flow as your central method? Thanks, Philip Guilford." What do you think about this one, Bob?
Yeah, watch the video. You know, here's another hidden genius who thinks a simple configuration of batteries and motors will produce unlimited energy, and that this fact has somehow escaped the minds of scores of thousands of engineers over the decades who work with this stuff every day.
Except Dennis Lee.
Oh my God, this, you know, it's so frustrating to watch and listen to this guy. I mean, there wasn't even a scintilla of creativity in his crackpot ideas. At least come up with something that's interestingly different than these millions of other guys that have come up with the same, you know, the same claptrap over Unity machines that produce more energy than they consume, over 100% efficiency.
At least have some hand-waving BS justification for where you think all this extra energy is coming from. He didn't even do that.
I know. It's like, right? I kept thinking, you know, why are we even covering this crap again? There's nothing new here. Please move on, you know.
I agree with you about this one. I agree. This is just yet another perpetual motion machine. The comments are always interesting. There is this subculture of people who think this is all possible. But I was struck by this guy's complete lack of humility. That's what struck me as well. The notion that, think about it. If you really think that you have cracked free energy with something that is so simple, you must think that you're some astounding genius, right? Or compared to all the scientific community of the world.
But he didn't even evince that fact at all, because he was saying, "Yeah, this is a simple little device I bought at Radio Shack for $1.50." You know, he didn't even seem like that. He thought he was smart. I mean, maybe, you know, deep inside he must be chuckling to himself, like, "Man, how smart must I be?" But
it's hard to say. I mean, I think that's the vibe he was giving off. I don't know if there's another video. I don't know if you watch his other videos.
Okay,
but when you watch his other videos, the guy's full of himself.
It's more overt. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would be full of myself if I really believed that I cracked this problem. Yeah, I'd be pretty cocky. But it's just so frustrating to watch this stuff, you know, over and over. And basically what he did, he runs a motor from a battery, and then the motor charges another battery. So when the first battery runs out, you swap it. You swap the batteries, so then the newly drained battery gets charged, and you could do that for a little bit. He did it for 50 hours. I guess his motor, you know, probably doesn't use that much energy, but you know, he was just impressed with this 50-hour run. You know, hey, do a month.
Yeah. So one thing we could say, I don't know if you said before, you can hear the motor running, right? You can, it's making noise,
right?
That means energy's being wasted or expended, vibrating the air molecules that vibrate your eardrums so that you can hear it. That's sound is energy radiating away from the system.
Right.
It's also sparking, giving off light. Whatever's giving off light, that's also energy that's radiating away as visible light. What he doesn't attempt to do is say, well, where's the extra energy he thinks is there coming from? I don't think he even realizes that that's the implication of what he's claiming.
He doesn't make that implication. He doesn't tie that together, and it makes it even more pathetic.
Now, Bob, you said run it for a month, but that would be more impressive. But even that's not good enough, because there are certainly you can build a machine that captures a lot of the energy and recycles it, and where it's very efficient and the amount of energy you're losing is so small that you can run it for these long, impressive periods of time.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
That still doesn't get you ever to perpetual motion. Also, there are some machines where there may be a hidden source of slight replacement energy. There may be some mechanical energy finding its way into the system somehow. And I kind of remember there was this one perpetual motion clock that was using changes in temperature, which would warp metals, and that was sort of driving the extra little energy that needed to be into the system.
Yeah, you can get real clever. You can get real clever with it and really hide it. But just the fact alone that you're going against laws of thermodynamics.
Oh yeah, I know.
Would make the bar so incredibly unbelievably high.
What I'm getting to is in order to prove it, I say you need to do two things. First of all, let's see something that's scaled up to the point that there isn't going to be some subtle, you know, aspect to it that we're missing. And also, don't just run the motor. Use it to actually generate electricity. Let me see you, you know, run something else off of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And not off a battery. I mean, that's the thing. Let's see. You know, I want to see an energy factory where you're generating massive amounts of energy. Because if you can't do that, then your claim's BS.
Right.
You know, not just look how long my little tiny motor ran. You know, not that kind of thing.
Right, there's a million ways to make it incredibly more impressive that nobody ever does. Why, I wonder.
And then when they can't scale it up and make a factory out of it, a power plant, they always think that it's some technical aspect. Oh, I just got to work out these technical details, and that's why it's not working, not because it's fundamentally flawed conceptually. They never go to that point.
Or if you're a scam artist, it's like, give me some money, and I'll iron out these last few wrinkles.
Yeah, what's been happening with Stern lately? Like, weren't they?
Nothing. What have you? Yeah, have you heard them in the news?
No.
I haven't seen them in the news. They're
still working out those kinks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, Steve chooses three science or news items, and it's up to his panel of skeptics to guess which ones are real and which one is the fake. This week, however, Steve shirked his science or fiction responsibility in order to spend all of his time in the arcade attempting to beat his previous high score for Street Fighter II. Isn't that right, Steve?
I came damn close, too.
Horseshoes and hand grenades. So this week, I have selflessly volunteered to step forward and take the helm. Are you all ready?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
All right. Steve, you're ready despite wasting the entire week vainly attempting to recapture your youth?
I'm not prepared, but I'm ready.
I've decided to give you four options today. And there's a theme. The theme is things the skeptics told to me minutes before we began recording tonight.
Oh, boy.
Can you be any more specific?
Item number one. Male genital amputation is an adaptive strategy, according to findings recently published by biologists from the Smithsonian and the National University of Singapore. Item 2. A team of geologists have just launched an expedition off the coast of Costa Rica, where they plan to be the first to drill into the Moho discontinuity, the upper boundary of Earth's mantle. Item number 3. The Oxford English Dictionary has traced the origin of the initialism OMG, which means oh my god, to a 1917 letter from a British admiral who wrote, "I hear that a new order of knighthood is on the table, OMG." Item number 4. Archaeologists in Brazil have discovered a saber-toothed vegetarian dinosaur. Okay. Steve, why don't you go first?
I always go first. That's not fair. That's why I have the worst record, because I always go first.
Mm-hmm, that's probably why.
That's exactly why. Mm-hmm.
The only reason why.
All right. Male genital amputation is an adaptive strategy. Can I ask you for whom?
No, you cannot.
For our alien overlord invaders that are coming to take over the world.
I mean, you know, obviously for the individual, if they have their genitals amputated before they have an opportunity to procreate, that's not evolutionarily adaptive. But, you know, there's scenarios in which restricting reproduction in a group might be adaptive for the group. So, you know, times of stress and competition, things like that. I could see how you could get to that headline. I'm not exactly sure what they're talking about. A team of geologists have launched an expedition off the coast of Costa Rica where they plan to drill into the Moho discontinuity, the upper boundary of Earth's mantle. That's very intriguing. That would be cool. But that's awfully deep. I don't know if we have the technology to do that. I'm a little suspicious of that one because I don't know if that technology exists. But I'm not ruling that one out. That's very intriguing. The Oxford English Dictionary has traced the origin of OMG to 1917. It's completely plausible that somebody would have used those letters to refer to "Oh my God" back in 1917. But I've never, you know, of course, I haven't read any of these, so I don't know how to assess the credibility of that one. It's just there's nothing that would make it impossible. And the last one, archaeologists in Brazil have discovered a saber-toothed vegetarian dinosaur. You know, it's hard not to believe any weird kind of dinosaur was found somewhere by somebody. Saber-tooth, I mean, you know, that just means they have long teeth. The saber-toothed tiger, for example, or the saber-toothed cat, not 100% sure what they used their saber-tooth for, but it probably was to slice through the jugular, slice through the neck of their victims. But doesn't mean you can't use a long knife-like tooth to process vegetation in some way. So that, again, it's not impossible. These are very tricky. I did a great job for your first time out, Rebecca. I think I'm going to have to go with the Moho discontinuity as the fiction, just because I think that one, which, you know, it's probably true because it's like such an extraordinary one. But I think... if I'm just basing it on plausibility, I think that's the one that's the most extreme.
Okay. Evan?
I'm a little disturbed by this first one about male genital amputation, for obvious reasons. An adaptive strategy? Well, I guess it's a strategy. It's a strategy, all right. So I think that one's unfortunately right. Then the Moho discontinuity. The Earth's mantle is pretty darn deep. You basically, in order to reach it, I think, you have to go to the trenches in the ocean floor and start digging down there. And like you said, Steve, I just don't know that we've got that capability. I mean, it's one thing to launch an expedition to come up with a plan for it. So that's possible to assess just how implausible or impossible it will be. So I'm not quite certain that one's actually the fiction. Moving on, OMG, meaning oh my God, to a 1917 letter from the British Admiral. Jeez, it just sounds funny. It's OMG, it could stand for so many things other than oh my God. Really, I'm having a hard time believing that's the case. I think somebody maybe saw this and made a funny story about it online or something, and that's maybe where they're getting that from. So I'm thinking that one's fiction. And saber-tooth vegetarian dinosaur, sure. Why not? Cutting through some pretty big vegetation that used to occur way back when. So it's between the Moho discontinuity and OMG. Plausibility versus total fabrication, I think. Well, I'll keep it interesting. I will say that the Moho discontinuity is a fact, and therefore that leaves OMG being the fiction. OMG is the fiction.
Okay, and Bob.
Damn, this is good. I agree with a lot of your assessments, Steve and Evan. The genital amputation, yeah, you can kind of twist that into some sort of group adaptive strategy. Oof, nasty. Yeah, the Moho discontinuity, boy. I mean, yeah, when you hear the mantle, you think many kilometers beneath the crust, and we can't even drill close through the crust to get to the mantle. But God, this Moho discontinuity kind of rings a bell for me. Is there a spot where the mantle comes up a lot higher? You know, I think I would have. It's possible, but I think I would be aware of the mantle being so close that it was even potential. There was a potential there to be drilled through. Yeah, I don't know about that one. And the point, Evan, you made about OMG, yeah, that could be the initials of somebody. It really could mean something other than oh my God. And how did the Oxford English Dictionary people determine what he was referring to? Yeah, I would think if you would definitively say that you trace the origin of something, of an acronym or an expression, that you would, you know, you'd have more than just the acronym. You'd be certain, especially one this old. The saber-toothed vegetarian dinosaur, yeah, I mean, I'll totally buy that.
It's probably the fiction. We all bought it so easily.
I've got, right? You don't even think about it. So, Steve, you got the Moho discontinuity, and Evan has got OMG. Okay. I'd hate to have Rebecca sweep. Yeah, I'll go with the Moho discontinuity. I think I would remember if the mantle was accessible by modern technology. I don't think it is.
Okay, so
OMG.
Steve and Bob believe that the geologist is fiction, and Evan believes that OMG is fiction. I'll take them in reverse order. Mm. I'll start with the one that you're all very sure about. Archaeologists in Brazil have discovered a saber-toothed vegetarian dinosaur. That is science. I wish I had made it up. If I'd been able to show you pictures, maybe you would have believed that that one was the fiction. One picture that's been floating around with the AP story, it's just got this ridiculous-looking dog-looking dinosaur with its mouth wide open, and it looks mentally challenged. That's all I'll say. But yes, it's true that archaeologists did in fact discover it, and it lived approximately 260 million years ago. And they believe that the saber tooths, the canines, were actually used for fighting or to protect against predators. It has a series of big teeth that were perfect for gnawing on plants. So they believe that it was, in fact, vegetarian, despite the giant saber tooths. Which probably makes some creationists very happy. I know that Ken Ham and the like pretend that the T-Rex was a gentle herbivore. And that's why, you know, they all live together in the Garden of Eden. Okay, next up is the Oxford English Dictionary has traced the origin of the initialism OMG to a 1917 letter from a British admiral. Evan, you believe this is fiction? This one is science.
Wow.
It's true that OMG is in fact, from 1917 letter. And the fact that they know that it meant oh my God is because he helpfully put oh my God in parentheses just after that initial.
That was very helpful.
Yeah.
That would do
It took a great deal of scholarship to turn that up.
Yeah, that's funny. I think, LOL.
I think you should have put dot 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 before that end quote, but that's okay.
Yeah, except for I didn't. So
No, I'm good with it. I'm good with it. I'm fine.
Yeah, Evan should be the one complaining here.
Yeah, I don't whine about such things. Other people.
For the
do,
record,
Bob.
It was the first Baron Fisher of Kilverstone who wrote the immortal words.
The Baron of Fisherstone?
The Baron? That's right. The what?
His name is John Arbuthnot Jackie Fisher, and I was going to put that in the question because I thought it sounded like the sort of silly name I would make up. But
oh, no, not at all.
I decided not
to. The Ministry of Silly Names.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wow. Next one. A team of geologists have just launched an expedition off the coast of Costa Rica, where they plan to be the first to drill into the Moho discontinuity, the upper boundary of Earth's mantle. Steve and Bob, you both said that this was fiction, and this one is fiction.
Yay! Oh,
that was my second guess.
Steve, was this your first win?
No.
No, okay.
It does help me average quite a bit, though.
Yeah, right. Considering you've done it like six times.
Well, Evelyn. Oh, and I should mention that. Yeah, the skeptics all did contribute these, and so.
Thank you, skeptics.
Yay, skeptics.
See, that's why I need a team of minions to make up my science.
I know. It really helped the process.
I can imagine.
You need Oompa Loompas or something, Steve. Yeah.
So, of course, Evelyn, your father we had on the show just a few weeks ago.
Okay, but I don't dance.
contributed this, and she is a geologist. And it's interesting because this is fiction, but it's very close to fact. An expedition did just launch to drill off the coast of Costa Rica. And it was actually, as Evan said, sort of the purpose of it isn't necessarily to test for deeper holes, but that will be a side effect of it. This drill will actually be coming within 3.5 kilometers shy of the Moho, which is a famous marker of just being the edge of the upper mantle. Mm-hmm. And so nobody's ever done it before. And it's actually, this is the 50th anniversary of the first unsuccessful attempt to drill down. but it was mostly waylaid by political issues, you know, getting the money and figuring out where to drill and getting the team together. The technology to actually drill down that deep is feasible, according to one of the scientists that is on this expedition to Costa Rica.
They just need to scale it up and work out of some hurdles.
Yeah, there are some the technology currently exists is tweakable, and this was published in the most recent, I believe, issue of Nature. So it's a really interesting article, and I recommend that you read it. And thank you to Evelyn for passing it along to me.
Awesome.
And I should mention that this same scientist actually gave a suggested time period because it's currently being explored, and they're hoping to, if they get funding, they're hoping to begin drilling within the decade and be completed within 15 years. So it's pretty exciting.
Wow, that's a lot of drilling.
And yeah, he also said that finding the rocks in that part of the Earth would be akin to the moon rocks coming back for examination. You know, this is stuff that they'll have never seen before, and it can solve a lot of scientific mysteries.
Cool.
So that leaves us with the first item. Male genital amputation is an adaptive strategy, according to recent findings published by biologists from the Smithsonian and the National University of Singapore. This one is, of course, science, and this one was given to me by Bug Girl. And so, of course, you can probably guess that the research refers to insects. Actually, it refers to spiders, and I can never remember if they're considered bugs or insects or whatever, because I know
arachnids.
That
they're
people
arachnids.
Like Bug Girl get really upset when you mix that up. So, yeah, arachnids. In particular, it refers to orb web spiders.
Oh, yeah.
Researchers found that eunuchs are better fighters, and also what happens when they mate. A very large percentage of the males, their genitals break off inside the female and effectively plug the female to prevent any other competitors from mating with her. And once they become eunuchs, they become fiercer defenders of the female. So these researchers found that it was actually this beneficial adaptive trait.
Yeah, but talk about putting all your eggs in one basket. I mean,
good one.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it's actually not it. Because one interesting thing.
Do they grow another one? I mean, what happens?
Worse. or better, I guess, depending on your point
grow,
of view.
They grow four.
They use the broken off genitalia again. They like pick it up and try again.
They hang it. They hang it from the rearview mirror. Oh boy.
They just plug it right back in there.
Oh, so it becomes a sex toy.
They're not quitters.
Point. So it's just detachable, is what you're saying.
The orb spiders, right? Like the song, detachable. Well, they're not actually penises, but yes.
Detachable organ.
I can't imagine that they work quite as well when they've become detached. But yeah, so I thought that was a really interesting piece, and thanks to Bug Girl for giving that one to me.
Thanks. Good job, Rebecca and the Skeptics. It was fun this week.
Thank you very much, guys. Good job, Steve and Bob. Sorry, Evan, but you've made Evelyn very happy that she got one past you.
Well, then... mission accomplished. If Evelyn's happy, I'm happy.
Exactly. So thanks, guys.
Jay was not with us this week. Jay is on vacation in Florida, having too good a time to join his fellow rogues to do the show.
It's snowing here.
Yeah.
Jay.
We had this sort of brief flirtation with spring, but then the snow decided to come back.
Gone.
It won't last, though. We're almost on to April. But Jay's in Florida.
So what,
living it up.
Well, what are we going to do about a quote this week, Steve?
I have a quote this week.
Wow, we're just mixing it up this week.
Yeah, it's
this is good.
The listeners aren't going to know what's happening.
I'm going to tell you the quote, and we'll see if any of you can guess who said it. Here is the quote. Galileo was a man of science oppressed by the irrational and superstitious. Today, he is used by the irrational and superstitious who say they are being oppressed by science. So 1984.
Dawkins?
Nope.
I'm just waiting for you to scream it, Steve.
Who just said that?
Guys don't know. Mark Chrislip. Mark Chrislip from Science Based Medicine and Quackcast. He has a really dry sense of humor that I love. And that he had actually, there's so many quotes from that article. This is an article on the Vaccine Council on Vaccination, which is also very 1984.
Yeah, right.
But that was a particularly good one. The whole Galileo complex, you know. Help, I'm being oppressed by science.
Isn't that a Monty Python skit from Holy Grail?
A couple of quick announcements. Actually, I'm just going to run through the events that we have booked for this year. There's so many of them, but that's Nexus is next. 2 weeks. Nexus, New
two
York.
Weeks. Two? Oh, boy.
Is it 2 weeks?
Wow. Less two than weeks. 2 weeks, if you're listening
and
to this.
If you can't make it to Nexus, what's wrong with you, first of all? But second of all, I will be giving a talk in Buffalo in Amherst, actually.
So
New
shuffle
York,
off.
For the Center for Inquiry on April 15th. And you can probably find more information on CFI's website.
By the way, with Nexus, it's in 2 weeks. We're selling about the same number of tickets as we did the last couple of years, but we expanded the size of the venue. So there's plenty of room, and there will be room even if you show up on the day. So if you decide,
and you can get cell service this year.
That's true.
Oh,
you decide on April 9th, you want to come to Nexus, just show up, and we'll be selling tickets at the door. And then the following weekend, April 15th to 17th, I will be at ICON, a science fiction convention that's at Stony Brook University in Long Island. And then Rebecca's thing, and then July 14th to 17th is TAM9 from Outer Space.
From Outer
Space. And then September 2nd to 5th is Dragon Con. We will make it to Dragon Con.
There'll be dragons there.
It's going to be awesome.
Then in October 27th in New Orleans is the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, CSI, is holding a skeptical conference. There will be an alternative medicine panel, and I will be there, as well as Harriet Hall and Edzard Ernst. I'm actually quite excited to meet Edzard.
And me.
I haven't met him. And Rebecca will be there. And one more quick announcement. If you are a skeptic in Africa, you might want to check out Consilience, a new podcast called an African Science Podcast put out by a South African skeptical organization. Check it out at consiliencecast.com. wordpress.com. Their first two episodes feature a two-part interview with me. So check it out. Well, thanks for joining me all this week.
Thank
Our
you,
pleasure.
Steve.
Hey, good to be here.
Jay will be back with us next week in cold Connecticut.
Supposedly. Ha.
But he'll probably have a tan. But until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice. Theorem is performed by Kineto and used with permission.